They are still getting sheen. It's being controlled. The sheen is being collected with sorghum material.
Digging up oil from a spill dating back to the 1964 earthquake. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a program that gets elementary school kids excited about college.
I want to be a geologist.
To be a mechanic.
Be a veterinarian.
I'm really thinking about being in the Air Force.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
Efforts to expand the harbor in Whittier have run up against an old oil spill. Last month, Harris Sand and Gravel dredges began pulling up gravel that was oily.
They encountered a level of oil contamination that they were not expecting.
That's Gary Folley, manager of the State Department of Environmental Conservation's Prevention and Emergency Response Program. Dredging work had to be halted until regulators from DEC and the Army Corps of Engineers decide how the contaminated gravel would be dealt with. They ended up piling it up on Alaska Railroad property near the end of the Anton Anderson Tunnel that connects Whittier with the Seward Highway. There is not much mystery about where the oil came from.
Based on the appearance, the weathered nature of the oil, and where it was encountered in the sediment, that it's likely that it's from the 64 earthquake and the oil storage tanks that were ruptured then.
The tank farm dates back even farther to when Whittier was a military port during the Second World War. During the earthquake, the tank farm was hit by several tsunami waves, one more than 100 feet high. Millions of gallons of fuel were released. A lot of it burned, but evidently some sank. Folley says the contaminated rock and gravel is really piling up.
We may be talking about 15,000 to 20,000 cubic yards of dredge spoil.
That's about 1,000 dump truck loads. Folley says the gravel is being drained before being added to the pile, and work has resumed with more precautions to protect the waters at the dredge site.
They are still getting sheen. It's being controlled. We're overseeing the work, and there's a silt curtain that's in place, several layers of hard and absorbent boom and sorbent material, and basically the sheen is being collected with sorbent material.
Folley says the extra work will add substantially to the cost of the $4 million Whittier project. A federal grand jury indicted three people today for the illegal sale of walrus ivory and polar bear hides from Savoonga. A federal grand jury charged three people from Glen Allen and Anchorage with 10 counts in violation of the Lacey Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and the Endangered Species Act. From KNOM in Nome, Ben Matheson reports.
A federal grand jury indicted three people today for the illegal sale of walrus ivory and polar bear hides from Savoonga. The grand jury in Anchorage charged three people from Glen Allen and Anchorage with 10 counts in violation of the Lacey Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and the Endangered Species Act. The three individuals are Jesse Joseph LeBoeuf, also known as Wade Gerard Christian, and Loretta Audrey Sternbach, both from Glen Allen, as well as Richard Blake Weschenfelder of Anchorage. Prosecutors say LeBoeuf and Sternbach paid for walrus ivory and polar bear hides purchased from residents of Savoonga with money or by trading guns, ammunition, marijuana, cigarettes, and snow machines. The indictment says they made two trips to Savoonga in July and August of 2010, purchasing more than 500 pounds of walrus tusks. LeBoeuf was arrested Tuesday after a search warrant was executed at his home in Glen Allen. Prior to his arrest, LeBoeuf exited his home and fired a shot. Law enforcement found marijuana and cocoa plants, along with firearms, stolen art, and hundreds of pounds of ivory. Weschenfelder is accused of marketing the walrus tusks over the internet, while Sternbach signed gift letters to make the transactions appear legal. The group sold about $22,000 of ivory and two polar bear hides to a non-Alaska Native buyer. Bruce Woods is a spokesman for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. He says the Marine Mammal Protection Act outlaws the commercialization of raw ivory.
Raw walrus ivory can be exchanged between Alaska Natives, but it can only be sold to non-Alaska Natives when it's been turned into a handicraft object. In this case, some of them were, as far as the information I have, raw walrus ivory, with no attempt to, you know, carve it or scrimshaw it or any of those things that might turn it into a piece of handicraft.
Wood says there is a possibility of charges against additional parties involved in the illegal trade in Savunga.
The investigation is ongoing, and there could be additional charges if the evidence supports those charges.
The indictment also lists firearm charges against LaBeouf for being a felon in possession of a firearm and the illegal possession and sale of a machine gun. The seven counts in violation of the Lacey Act carry a maximum of 5 years in prison and fines to $250,000, while the firearm indictments carry a maximum sentence of 10 years and fines to $250,000. Reporting in Nome, I'm Ben Matheson.
Hundreds of people rallied in Fairbanks yesterday to protest what they see as overreach by the federal government. The Fed Up with the Feds event was also a fundraiser for Jim Wilde, the central man arrested last fall following a conflict with rangers in the Yukon Charley Rivers National Preserve. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
71-year-old Jim Wilde is fast becoming a folk hero for Alaskans who see the National Park Service as a bully agency. The story of the crusty old hunter who resisted armed rangers' attempt to stop his boat for a safety check has fueled resentment that was very evident at the Fed Up rally.
The shotgun's made for cocking, and that's just what I'll do. Yes, Mr. Wilde, we're here to get compliance out of you.
The event was organized by the advocacy group Sportsmen for Fish and Wildlife. Group president and former state senator Ralph Seekins says the goal was to raise awareness of agencies like the Park Service overstepping their legal authority.
We're seeing more and more in Alaska, particularly, where we're a long ways away from the sight of anybody else, where there's federal government is intervening into areas of state sovereignty. And we just want to bring that to light to the people. We're not here to start a revolution, but we're here to start an information revolution, so to speak.
Topics ranging from wildlife and natural resource management to health care reform were covered by Fed Up Rally speakers. State Wildlife Conservation Director Corey Rossi said the state's ability to manage fish and game is being hampered by new federal concepts.
Custodial management, natural diversity, biodiversity, and wilderness or wildlands policies are being used to usurp traditional population and harvest management on federal lands. While these concepts may be attractive to those who oppose consumptive use, they ring hollow for those who depend on consistency in Alaska's bounty to provide for their families.
Rossi said the federal policies inhibit tactics like predator control. Senator Lisa Murkowski and Congressman Don Young also addressed the rally. Young has been an outspoken supporter of Jim Wilde and is critical of the Park Service for what he sees as illegal regulation of Alaska's sovereign waters. Young said he's part of an effort in Congress to rein in federal agencies.
EPA, NIMS, and very frankly, I am going after the Park Service.
Young said he's teamed with fellow representatives from other western states to cut agency budgets.
We have many congressmen. When we passed the continuing resolution of 2011 for the budget, that was the area it was cut the most. We whacked the bejesus out of them because people are upset because the overreach of the boat. There's no reason by anybody who works for an agency to think that this is their land. This does not belong to the agency. It belongs to the people.
Many who attended the rally were there to support Jim Wilde's legal battle with the Park Service. Wilde is awaiting ruling by a federal judge on misdemeanor charges stemming from his conflict with NPS Rangers. Longtime Alaskan Diane Marshall wore a T-shirt with a creative interpretation of NPS.
Nazi police state. This was the T-shirt that they did in support of Jim Wilde. And I wanted today to bring it, and I got Lisa Murkowski and Don Young to sign it. I wanted to make sure that I really had their support, and I figured if they signed the shirt, they'd do that.
The wild case has drawn Alaskans into a long simmering battle between the state and federal government over jurisdiction of navigable waters in Alaska. States are granted the right to manage them, but courts have ruled federal agencies can regulate them where they pass through their lands. Wild's attorney, Bill Satterberg, says his client's case is the first to specifically consider state management guarantees included in the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act.
ANILCA creates a rather unique series of, a unique legislative framework that says that the state of Alaska has got much greater control over its lands and its waters than other states in the United States would have over theirs. And that's really the heart of the legal issue in the wild case, to be honest with you, is to sit down and figure out whether or not ANILCA controls.
A decision in the wild case is expected in mid-May. Satterberg says if Wild loses on any counts, the case will be appealed to higher courts, a challenge of federal authority likely to be joined by the state of Alaska. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, discussing a documentary that tells the story of clergy sex abuse in Alaska.
They were our key to salvation, and instead they turned around and robbed our souls.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. The Alaska Budget Report, providing in-depth coverage for state government since 1991, on the web at akbudgetreport.com. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for over 30 years.
State House Democrats today made public a plan that would successfully end the special legislative session, now at the conclusion of its 11th day. The Senate and Governor Sean Parnell are at odds over the governor's recent threats to use his line item veto on capital projects in the districts of senators who did not support the administration's oil tax reduction plan. The governor says contingency language bundling projects together in the Senate's budget bill takes away that line item veto power. Anchorage's Mike Dugan suggested three simple steps to resolve the dispute. He says the governor needs to back down from threatening to veto projects based on oil taxes, the Senate needs to withdraw the contingency language, and the governor, House, and Senate need to go over the capital projects in the budget to decide in advance which of them have merit.
And that's it. Sorry that it's that simple, but it is that simple. And if everyone could do their part and stop this, which I can only characterize as bickering that's going on about this, we could be out of here in 2 days, maybe three.
Anchorage Democrat Les Guerra said the House Finance Committee, of which he is a member, needs to review the controversial energy-related projects in the capital budget instead of going to Anchorage tomorrow for hearings.
And instead of sort of pretending that we don't know what these projects are about, we've had the last 2 weeks that we could have been holding hearings on them. And we should move ahead and vet the projects. We can do that in the Finance Committee. We know what the projects are. We could have been holding hearings. We should hold hearings. And we should get this resolved as soon as possible instead of pointing fingers back and forth.
For his part, the governor's staff today commented that the governor has assured the Senate president and co-chairs that he will not abuse his line item veto authority. If lawmakers can't come to an agreement with the governor, former Attorney General John Havelock says they may have to push through to test the issue. Havelock was Attorney General from 1970 to 73 under Governor Bill Egan. He's now in private practice and teaches public policy at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Havelock says it's not predictable what the state Supreme Court might do regarding the idea of the constitutionality of bundling legislation to protect it from a gubernatorial veto. Havelock says if the governor receives the legislation with the projects bundled, he should disregard the contingency language and choose vetoes based on his opinion of what the Constitution allows.
It could mean the end of, the dispute, for all I know. I mean, because we don't, one of the big unknowns in this situation is exactly what would the governor veto. And that card needs to be played.
Havelock says the legislature then must decide if the vetoes are serious enough that they should work to override them or possibly seek legal clarity and sue. Alaska's constitution is unusual in the amount of power given to the governor. Not only can he veto line by line, but he can reduce the amount of money allocated to a project. Havelock says it's very uncommon, and there was fear that it would wreak havoc on the legislature's appropriation power by allowing the governor to pick and choose.
But the experience in Alaska has not been that. The experience in Alaska is that governors have been cautious and careful about using the line item veto and reduction.
Havelock says if the matter was pursued in court, the issue is important enough that he feels it would be fast-tracked and would not be tied up for years. Across Alaska, the I'm Going to College program is bringing more than 2,300 students from more than 30 schools to 13 college campuses. This is the first time Dillingham kids have participated. KDLG's Daisha Eaton has the story.
What do you want to be when you grow up? That's the question being asked of fifth and sixth graders across the state right now in a program called I'm Going to College. Here are a few of their answers.
I want to be a geologist.
To be a mechanic.
Be a veterinarian.
I'm really thinking about being in the Air Force.
Those kids are in Dillingham. They're spending the day at the University of Alaska Bristol Bay campus through the I'm Going to College program, sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education. They're learning about
college and how much it costs and what it takes to start thinking ahead and preparing for college.
That's Brenda Overcast. She's the Education Outreach Coordinator at UAA Bristol Bay. Although their school is literally located right next door to the university, Overcast says for many of the kids, this is the first time they've stepped foot on a college campus or even thought about college at all. The program is aimed at introducing those kids to the idea of college and getting them thinking about what comes after high school sooner. As Overcast explains, they don't necessarily expect all the kids to get a PhD or even do the traditional 2-year or 4-year degree route.
And I think that's what we're trying to push, is go to school afterwards and, yeah, find a career and find something that you want to do that will help you and bring it back here to help our communities. And I think that's really important.
The kids spend most of the day on the UAA campus. They get to go to 4 different classes that introduce them to 4 different career paths.
The healthcare one, energy, learning about computers, and then the environmental sciences.
My name is Lily Capel. I work at the Bristol Bay campus in the environmental science lab. Today we're just introducing the kids to environmental science and the isopod.
Isopods are crustaceans that look a lot like underwater cockroaches. Besides being a climate change indicator species, they play a key role in the food chain, using their 14 legs equipped with Freddy Krueger-like knives to shred dead salmon carcasses left in rivers after fish spawn. The lab is filled with kids and clear jugs of water full of squirming crustaceans. So what do isopods have to do with college?
We use the isopod as a tool to captivate the students and then trick them into learning about science.
In the adjacent room, the lights are out and kids are powering a light bulb with a bicycle. Sustainable energy professor Tom Marsick.
So here we are getting kids excited about college because we believe it's important to start at an early age. And I specifically am getting excited them about energy and about sustainable energy, to be even more specific.
The kids are using a bicycle to power 2 kinds of light bulbs, a regular one and an energy efficient one, then comparing how much pedaling it takes to get each of them to light up. Another experiment aimed at turning kids onto the idea of going to college. Dillingham High School officials say right now less than a quarter of their students typically go to college, right around the national average. Danny Frazier is the assistant superintendent at Dillingham High School.
The national average of children leaving high school and going to college is around 20%. And I would say we're probably in the average that even though they self-report they're going, probably we only send about 20%. One thing that we know is that when children set their goals early in life, that it becomes a goal for the rest of their life. So the earlier we can get them interested in going to college, are in other careers, the more likely they are to fulfill those goals.
Frazier says he's behind anything that gets kids setting goals earlier. Back in the isopod lab, Professor Capel's kids are racing the isopods in a water-filled racetrack.
college, and I get to play with isopods all day.
Okay, are you guys ready?
I'm betting on Michael.
Are you marked, set, go!
Paul Kopoff is one of the fifth graders spending the day at UAA. He says he's not that interested in studying the isopods, but he is interested in being another kind of scientist.
And do you want to go to college?
Yeah.
What would you like to study?
Rocket science.
Whether or not Paul goes on to become a rocket scientist or not isn't the point. It's that he's thinking about it. And with any luck, he'll be blasting off toward college in about 8 years. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Full Circle. Full Circle grows, picks, and delivers fresh, certified organic produce year-round. More information about their 400-acre farm and their organic partners at fullcircle.com.
The Medallion Foundation, with safety training programs and 16 flight simulators statewide, supports the Alaska Airmen's Association trade show and convention on April 30th and May 1st at Ted Stevens Anchorage International Airport. There'll be a full-motion Super Cub simulator for demonstration to the aviation public. The Medallion Foundation, changing the culture of flight safety. For more information, go to medallionfoundation.org. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
The family of an Alaska-based airman killed in Afghanistan has identified him as Major David Broder of Auburn, Massachusetts. A veteran Afghan military pilot said to be distressed over his personal finances opened fire at Kabul Airport after an argument yesterday, killing seven other U.S. troops and an American civilian contractor. Broder's family, in a statement, says he was an advisor to the Afghan Command and Control Center under NATO Air Training Command, Afghanistan. He was deployed in February. Broder was married and had two children. A lot of silence surrounds the issue of Catholic clergy abuse of children in rural Alaska villages. But a documentary film showing and a panel discussion at the Beartooth Theater in Anchorage tonight are aimed at bringing the issue out into the open. The film is called The Silence. It aired on the PBS show Frontline last week. Since then, producer Tom Curran says he's heard a flood of reaction from viewers.
They really connected to it on a visceral level. I mean, they just felt it in the gut. And in that way, I think there's a real sense of empathy and sadness. But in the same breath, of at least what I've heard, is that there's some hope. You know, people are seeing that there's some real strength in a story like this being told, and survivors like Elsie and Alberta stepping forward and you know, revealing a very dark chapter in a very honest and real way.
The panel discussion tonight includes Curran, Gretchen Schmelzer, a psychologist who specializes in trauma, and Elsie Boudreau, a survivor of clergy sex abuse from St. Mary's. Boudreau now works as an advocate for victims. She says the survivors who speak out in the film are thankful they were part of the project.
And I think there's a lot of strength that comes from the unity in sharing the story together and having the support of people all around us.
Was it important for people to tell the story in a public way? It's a story that would be very, very difficult to tell to one person, much less such a large audience. How was that?
Well, I think to be able to tell the story, tell one story in a public ear, if you will, really... it's almost like it solidified the truth, and it reached, maybe there's some hope that it would reach not just the church, but, you know, people in the villages, so that, because, I mean, the truth does, not to use this pun, I mean, the truth does set people free, you know, but it's almost like it would... allow people to be heard, and maybe even by, you know, I mean, I just had this thought now, like it could be heard by the Creator in a different way, you know. So reaching beyond the church.
Sort of a public prayer for healing?
Yes, that's a good way to put a public prayer for healing, yes.
What are you hoping comes out of the discussion tonight?
Well, I hope from the discussion tonight that it kind of bridges that prayer to real life, you know, and allows for some brainstorming or, you know, some way of like coming to a point of a plan for healing for people. And I also, you know, I hope people, we hear reactions from people about the film and about this reality. I would hope to hear strong reactions.
And so do you think the film and tonight's discussion will get people talking about the history of clergy abuse in rural Alaska? Is that part of the goal with this effort?
I would hope so, because, you know, people talking about this whole idea of priests being on a pedestal for so long and so highly respected, and parents for so long not believing their children, you know, the reality is that they had perpetrator priests in our villages for generations, and generations of children were abused. And we see the ramifications of that today in their children. And so, I mean, just looking at some statistics that, you know, when I worked with the law firm that were gathered, you know, there's nowhere in the country where, and like, for example, in 1967, there were 40 priests in Alaska with the Fairbanks Diocese. 12 of them were identified as perpetrator priests. That's 30%, you know, and in some villages, we had people that were, and we had perpetrator priests in a village for, you know, 3 decades, you know, and the children had nowhere to turn. You know, they were the saviors. They were our key to salvation. And instead, they turned around and robbed our souls.
Elsie Boudreau is a survivor of clergy sex abuse and is featured in the documentary The Silence. The film showing and panel discussion will start at 8 p.m. tonight at the Beartooth Theater in Anchorage. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Ben Matheson in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Dacia Eaton in Dillingham. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come. The Center for Distance Education at UAF, offering online courses from any location. Information at distance.uaf.edu/learn.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. No other port in Alaska is building a 100 rail car loop like the one going in at Port McKenzie. Exporting natural resources from rail to ship will be more efficient than ever. A single limestone deposit in the interior could mean a cement industry in Alaska. Port McKenzie Rail, hundreds of millions in state revenues, thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska-Susitna Borough.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.